Hello, everyone. This is Vlad Glavanu. I am director of the Center for Creativity and Innovation at Webster University Geneva. And it is my great pleasure to be here today with two of my colleagues, Pier Paolo Andriani from Kedge Business School, France, and Renata Kaminska, Schema Business School and University Côte d'Azur. Hello.
Hi.
Hello.
We had a great talk from you yesterday on creativity, innovation, processes, and context. And your talks complemented each other, but they came from quite different spaces somehow. So I'm going to start a little bit with Pier Paolo. On the basic idea that we took about the process of innovation is that, at least the idea I took, is that it's not always an intentional process that the creator or inventor initiates voluntarily and has like a mental image of where they're going with it. But you presented to us very interesting processes that I would like you to, you know, to comment on a little bit on how objects or situations bring to our awareness something that already has happened. So innovation kind of being in the world rather than starting from the head. Would you agree with this small summary of what you said, Pier Paolo?
Yes, definitely. In fact, Kevin Kelly, you know, the author of lots of books, very, very important, is of technology, has coined a term called the technium. Uh-huh. The technium complements the other kingdoms of life. In his opinion, technology right now has become an autonomous force in the development of the planet, the interaction between humans and the planet. What is a technium? The technium is a set of interacting technologies that now set in a way their own direction, which we humans contribute to, but also discover.
Right.
So we discover the possibilities in the technium, and often processes like acceptations or coadjuvated by others like serendipity and so on, basically let us get a hint of the directions of technological development, which are already hidden in the technologies themselves.
Right. You mentioned a key term that came up yesterday from Darwin's work that I would like you to just define briefly for us, for those who are interested in what acceptation might be about.
Yeah, acceptation is just a term that in evolutionary biology was introduced by Charles Darwin. Darwin had a problem. Basically, what is the use of 5% of an organ? So if you've got 5% of a wing, what are you going to do? Nothing. It will not contribute to your fitness. But in order to get 100% of a wing, you've got to go through 5% of a wing.
Right.
So that was a problem for Darwin. And his brilliant solution was, yes, 5% of a wing cannot let you fly, but can let you do other things. But once you develop then a wing for other functions, then it is pre-adapted for flight.
Right.
And that's the concept of acceptation. So it's a trait, an organ, a technology, a module, which is just been developed to play a certain function, the historical function, which is then co-opted to play a new function.
Right. And going from the wing of birds or ancestors of birds to some concrete examples, you had some fantastic examples yesterday of how in society, in medicine, especially in the pharmaceutical area, these things come about. Could you refer maybe to one of them to have a concrete sense of how this happens?
The most well-known one, of course, is Viagra. Viagra was introduced, the name of the molecule is sildenafil. It was introduced for angina pectoris. And then the legend goes that patients, male, older, didn't return the samples, which is not true because the test was done in a clinical setting.
Okay.
But it's true that that application, which became for Pfizer, basically the blockbuster number one, was totally unexpected.
Right.
And actually, it's not even the most important, the most interesting examples. Other examples in the history of pharmaceutics include basically the emergence of the entire field of antidepressants and the entire field of antipsychotic. Basically, the entire, if you want, psychopharmacology or biological psychiatry is entirely an effect of unexpected functions hidden in drugs developed either for surgery, anesthesia, in the case of antipsychotic, or tuberculosis, anti-tuberculosis in the case of antidepressants.
Right. Right. I remember I use this example sometimes in class about the post-it note, which is a very simplistic, perhaps, idea. But to me, it spoke quite vividly about solutions looking for a problem and how in the history of it, apparently, they want to develop a super strong glue. They develop a super weak glue and no one knew what to do with it until, you know, kind of a decade later. I think a second person had a second look at it. And I think what people are very interested in is, how do we become aware of these things? So when we innovate, right, what is that moment and what might trigger it? Do you have to be in a special state of mind? Do we have any kind of evidence or work done, research work on how that happens? Because it's hard to predict, obviously, but any understanding of preconditions or triggers, what would those be?
You're taking me out of my comfort zone. I'm not a psychologist, you know. I'm just interested in the management of technology and innovation, mm-hmm. especially in the historical side. Again, it's out of my comfort zone. You need to be able, because if the function that the technology is revealing is entirely new function, new to the world, mm-hmm. then by definition, you have to break disciplinary boundaries.
Right.
By definition. And the person has to be able to have a kind of predisposition for the new functions or functionalities that the acceptation has revealed.
Right.
Now, I can give examples. The French doctor that basically started the field of antipsychotic, Henri Laborie. Henri Laborie was called the enfant prodige, but also the difficult person in French medicine. Mm. The story goes that he was candidate for the Nobel Prize, and the elite of French doctors went to Stockholm and say, please don't give him the Nobel Prize.
So you need that kind of people.
You need people who are predisposed to work across boundaries. And Laborie was not only an excellent surgeon, not only a rebel, but it was a special person, extremely curious to go beyond surgery. And in fact, it was. And then he became a guru of kind of new age in his old age. Yesterday, I reported the example of the British doctor that basically started the father of modern surgery, Joseph Lister. Joseph Lister started basically the field of what we call antiseptic surgery, from which aseptic surgery, which is dominant, mm-hmm. Came from. And Joseph Lister was uniquely positioned to discover antiseptic surgery. Why?
Right.
Because his father became a member of the royal... His father was a wine merchant, a Quaker. A wine merchant, but also an amateur scientist. And basically, he solved the problem of achromatic aberrations in microscopes. So basically, young Joseph came up with the best microscopes that you could find on planet Earth.
Right.
And predisposed to thinking in terms of germs.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, his father published with Hodgkin, the guy of the Hodgkin lymphoma, papers about the germs that could be seen in 1830s.
Right.
But he was also a chemist. He had studied, by the way, classical languages, Latin and Greek. Mm. And, of course, he was a surgeon. At the time, where surgeons were practical men, in that case.
Right.
So he was predisposed to pick the signs of the germ theory of diseases. And that sign came from the property of a material called carbolic acid,
right?
A phenol. That gave him the idea, in my opinion.
So basically, you're doing a big service here with this approach and highlighting these cases to basically my discipline, which is psychology of creativity, where we still often operate with the idea of the great man theory. Sadly, more rarely great women, because of all the ideological baggage of genius and creativity and so on that, you know, is contested today. But the idea that there is something special within the person, there might be something, individual differences related, you know, a certain constellations of, you know, personality traits, a certain thinking style. But you're also saying that there is the almost like a sociological positioning within a network of institutions, family legacy, you know, moment in time as well, right? So that all matters. And I'm going to use this opportunity opportunity to make a connection with Renata's work, because we talked a lot about science, but it seems to me that exactly these mechanisms are fundamental for the work of an artist. To step back from what conventions tell you that an object is or could be about, and just look at it with completely new eyes, right? One of the examples I like to give is like a water glass or anything that has a very clear function in society, and then an artist can glue it to the wall and call it conceptual art, which is, you know, but it wasn't produced for that. Or found objects, the whole idea of art with found objects is kind of, you know, subverting the function. You work with artists, or one of your projects, Renata, with artists in the area of Nice. First of all, what brought you to this kind of interest, and what are your main questions when you study this this whole environment?
Well, what brought us is a very interesting research project. Mm-hmm. And the project had three objectives. The first one was to try to understand the career paths of artists in the region.
Right.
The second one was to understand if the digital devices had any impact on the networking that is happening in that particular environment. And the third one was to understand how the spaces for creativity enable or maybe block creativity among all these individuals. So this is how the whole interest in creativity and artists started.
Right. And you had a very intriguing question. Everyone thinks of southern France and Nice as a super creative place for artists for historical reasons. But you raised the question, you know, maybe it might not be that encouraging of creativity. So how did you come to that question and conclusion in a way?
Well, this was work that I've done with a colleague of mine from University Côte d'Azur, Linda Ravez, who is a museologist, actually, and she spends a big part of her life in archives, studying archives. So this collaboration allowed me to dig deeper into the history of the region. We have realized that basically there are almost like two parallel worlds living next to each other, but they don't communicate. So the official sort of like an elitist group of artists who expose their artwork in the art galleries that you see all along these big streets in the French Riviera region, and then you have a whole bunch of artists that struggle to survive and that struggle to make themselves visible and promote what they call the utopia of social art.
Yes,
because what they believe in is that art should be sort of done in along the philosophy that creativity means creating with the local people for the local people and not in separation from the local population,
everyday life and urban space. Interesting. And you used a beautiful concept that came out of work of other colleagues on the middle ground.
Right.
And that's something very useful to think about. How would you define this middle ground?
The middle ground, it's mainly the work by Patrick Coende from HEC Montréal and colleagues. The middle ground is basically a space which is located somewhere in between the upper ground and the lower ground. It's a space that is not really associated with official institutions, like companies or, you know, official sort of like high-end museums and theaters and so on, universities. Right. But these are spaces where people, real people, meet.
Right.
They exchange, they talk about what they do, and they develop new projects, and they co-create together. They basically interact.
Right. So the middle ground becomes this enabler, right? If we look at context, because that's the beauty of how your talks for me relate to each other, this idea that process and context, you know, they're quite interdependent, and instead of looking just at the person of the creator, or even just at the object alone, we have to understand quite an ecology over there.
Right.
As Pier Paolo is mentioning, you know, family legacies and the moment in time and certain inventions. So in Nice, you would need this environment to create. And in your work, did you come up in the end with some kind of practical conclusions for struggling artists in the Nice area, or what kind of outcomes? Yes,
maybe not conclusions, but there were two things that we observed. The first one was the role of this unofficial carnival. Uh-huh. That runs in parallel with the Nice official carnival, and this event was spontaneously created by a group of people in the area of Nice, which is called Saint-Roch, and basically these people decided to involve the local population in the organization of the carnival, and basically they run it every year, and it's more than anything else, it's just a meeting place. It's a middle ground. Right. It's a space where people meet local people who live there, and have no other opportunity to do things together. And
right.
For these people, culture means co-creating something regularly and with I would say positive externalities, which manifest themselves in some kind of social value that is created through this interaction.
So community building and artistic production,
absolutely,
right?
That
just
go
to
along,
call it
right.
What it is.
And another one is this real space, which is which is called Entrepont.
Uh-huh.
And it's basically the rehabilitated slaughterhouses that the city decided to give to a federation of associations, artistic associations, that basically allow them to go and have place where to meet with the public, create and
right.
so on. So these are two different manifestations of these middle spaces,
right,
where artists can meet, produce, and interact with the public, basically.
Yeah. I mean, in a way, if I'm to tie back to the previous discussion, it's the initial function, which is quite fascinating, of how artists, for me, they embody this mentality of subverting a function, right? And it's beautiful, I mean, imagine for them as well, that an abattoir could become something so completely
right.
different in a way. And then you have all these analogies one can make between blood, life, whatever that can happen, and then a new life kind of coming on. So towards the end, I want to raise a few questions for both of you, because I was thinking about what ties things together. And we didn't have time yesterday to discuss a lot about negative impacts of things. So I was just mentioning about malevolent creativity is a new direction of research in my area, which talks about creativity that is intended to harm some people, some context, even when sometimes people think they're doing only good, sometimes there are consequences that are not so positive. So when we talk about this reverse innovation and engineering of things, we have these positive examples. You know, we invented antidepressants. Of course, they also come with negative consequences, right? People who maybe have overdoses or whatever, right? Do we have stories of things that you know, instead of looking at the positive, looking at the negative of inventions that should not have happened and look what they turned out to be? What do you think, Pier Paolo? Are these cases that people in your field want to understand?
Well, I mean, unexpectedness goes both ways.
Right.
So you get mostly technologies, especially new technologies, manifest themselves via unexpected effects that are both negative and positive. And sometimes what is negative for one group of people is positive for another group of people.
Right.
A typical example is side effects in drugs.
Right.
Side effects can be very negative for a group of people, but could be beneficial for another group of people. So the question is how to govern basically the emergence of unexpected functions, effects, you know. And history is largely like that.
Right.
Fernand Braudel basically said history is about history of unexpected, unintended consequences.
Right.
And a consequence could be, I mean, yesterday I reported on the case of thalidomide. Thalidomide is a drug that is the worst pharmaceutical scandal in the history of the industry. But the fact that thalidomide was so dangerous for pregnant women indicated that they had a deep function in the formation, basically, of the nervous systems. So, and then you can use it. And then it became an incredible drug, right, which was reapproved under severe constraints, but was reapproved for an incredible host of other conditions.
Right. So, but not pregnant women, I suppose. From
no, in fact, no,
interdictions.
In fact, actually, in fact, there is a patent about how to administer thalidomide. Now, the industry has developed new forms which are less dangerous.
Right, right. Well, one example, and of course, here is this gliding from. These concepts and studies have been done on evolution, which is, again, you know, you don't usually think of it as better, worse in ethical terms. I mean, it's a bigger discussion here, obviously, and technology, but in a social arena and humanities arena where it kind of come from, I can only think of social media and the unexpected emergence around new ways of communicating between people. So there was a huge joy and expectation that we're going to be connected, learn from difference, hear each other out. And then information bubbles, conspiracy theories, and misinformation reign supreme in a lot of parts of social media. And that takes me actually to the middle ground and to the networks. Are they always so positive? I mean, I'm looking at these online communities, which is not what you study, Renata, granted. But can the middle ground be a fertile ground, if I may, for malevolent forms of creativity? Have you thought about that? Or are we attracted a lot to this positive side of things? Are we romanticizing a little bit different things? It's just a very open question, you know?
Of course. No, I never thought of it that way, but basically I believe the middle ground is these spaces where artists can meet and create networks are extremely important, because without them it's very difficult for them to meet, especially in places like the French Riviera, where the real estate prices are extremely high.
Right.
So there is no possibility to acquire individually enough space to kind of exchange, because you need space to paint, you need space to practice the performing arts and so on. But what I wanted to say is that you were talking about networks and social networks,
media,
and the big question that we have in this project is how do artists use social media to promote themselves, to go to the upper ground and to be recognized, and maybe which may help them find a job or a contract or something, because that's one of the biggest problems they have. And actually, this is not my focus, but my colleagues seemed to suggest that one of the problems that the artists have is that it takes some competency and also it takes time to be able to know how to use these social media platforms, and they don't exactly know how to do it. So it's almost like a specific competency that one must have, and they focus on their creative production rather than on that. So it can actually have a negative, you know, the existence of these social media can have a negative impact on their careers.
Because they're not self-entrepreneurs and influencers.
Exactly.
So you need an added skill. I mean, that's exactly going back to what Pier Paolo said that it's in the field of the openness and the unexpected, good and things and bad things come about. It would always depend on group of reference, period of time, and I think the final thing I wanted to kind of direct all of us to is the idea of open-mindedness. I think when we talk about features or abilities or mindsets that we should maybe cultivate in people, it seemed to me from both your talks that it's how to keep an open mind towards what might happen and not to be trapped functional fixedness, not to be, you know, trapped within expecting something to happen or just seeing one function for one object. Any kind of advice of how we can entertain this? I mean, it's a very broad thing, and I don't know that you didn't ask this question in your research, but from historical examples or interviews with artists, what do people need to be more open-minded about things? Well, I'm going to start with you, Renata, because you work with artists.
That's a big question.
So they need spaces, right? And good social media skills, that can help. But how do we educate and think of you know, more open-minded?
I think that, but this has nothing to do with my project. I think that in the educational system that we have where I live, we don't expose young people enough to the importance of creativity and art, basically. We are very much focused on, you know, sciences, and I think that it's one of the reasons for which children and young adults do not see that creativity is basically. I think that it could exposing them more to these issues, to art, to create.
Right, to this middle ground space.
Right,
spaces,
to this middle ground spaces.
Festival.
Meet with the artists and so on, like what you organize here, kind of open up their mind to the possibility of recombining the different ideas and looking, maybe finding new things.
Right,
this
right.
Transdisciplinarity that Pier Paolo just mentioned.
Exactly, I want to exactly to come. So, diversifying experiences, and then Pier Paolo, yesterday you mentioned a little bit of transdisciplinarity. So, if you're not born within a family that for generations made the best microscopes in the world, how do you still have a chance maybe to participate in the process you talked about? Is it just luck, or do we have to educate people for different type of skills and mindsets than maybe we are now? In a science perspective, what would be a lesson there?
I mean, in terms of technology development, science, one corner of the question is about institutions. Mm-hmm. So, and which then reflect this idea of middle ground and higher ground and lower ground. So institutions should be set in a way that allow for unintended consequences to emerge and to be exploited,
right?
To be sought after, and to be then worked upon and later exploited for societal benefit.
Right.
And this is not what's been happening in the past. Nassim Taleb is the very controversial writer, the guy of the Black Swan, and you know. And he has coined a term, extreme, as everything he writes. He called the Soviet Harvard Syndrome, whereby...
What is that about? Do we suffer from it?
The Soviet Harvard Syndrome is this idea that we know in advance what we're doing. And we think we know the means to judge what's happening. So in that case, we can discriminate between the science and technology we want to develop and the science and technology we don't want to develop. But we assume that we know. So the unknown unknowns don't exist in that world. And right. Our institutions are increasingly reshaped in the sense that we need to reduce waste of taxpayers' money, which means we have to identify what we want to do, identify the agents that can deliver against the societal wishes, and around a set of prefix methodologies and so on. And that's a way, definitely it's a way to cut bad projects, but it's also a way to cut very risky projects. And that's been dominant in the past 40, 50 years.
Right.
So it's basically a way to reduce or to make it difficult for an intended consequence or for exaptive processes to emerge.
Right. So welcoming a bit more of uncertainty, having a bit of risk taking, and in the way we work with students and in research projects, we always need the hypothesis and need the expectation, but allowing more openness from education to research to practice, I think that would be kind of a goal we're all working towards. Thank you very much, both of you, for these very insightful comments. This has been a discussion with Dr. Pierpaolo Andriani from Kedge Business School and Renata Kaminska, Schema Business School and University Côte d'Azur. I'm Vlad Glavanu, and I welcome you to listen to more podcasts in our series. You can access them at podcast.webster.ch. Thank you both very much.
Thank you, Vlad.